The slaves responded well to this treatment, and incredibly began to put on the weight that they had burned off during the fevers that were the result of the inoculation against the smallpox. The mood of the slaves was resigned and compliant, although there were isolated incidents. One morning, while a batch of slaves were being brought up, one of them, a fine-looking naked woman, managed to work free the shackle of her chain, and the moment she reached the deck, she rushed to Huron's side and leapt over it, into the creaming blue wake of the racing clipper. Despite the fact that she still wore the iron cuffs on her wrists, she managed to keep afloat for many long minutes. Her struggles were pitiful to watch as she was slowly drawn down lower and lower in the water. Robin had run to the rail to watch the woman's efforts, expecting Mungo to heave to and lower a boat to rescue her. But he remained detached and silent on his quarterdeck, barely glancing over the stern before occupying himself once more with the management of his ship, while Huron tore away and the woman's head dwindled to a speck on the blue water, then was drawn inevitably below the surface by the weight of her iron cuffs. Although Robin realized that it would have been impossible to stop the clipper and reach the woman before she drowned, yet she glared at Mungo across the length of the deck, wishing that there were words to express her fury and indignation. That night, she lay awake in her tiny cabin, hour after hour, racking her imagination for some ruse that could be used to delay the tall clipper's full flight towards the southern cape. She thought of stealing one of the ship's boats and casting herself adrift during the night, forcing Mungo to turn back and to search for her. It took only a few minutes' reflection to realize that it would take a dozen strong men to free the whaler from its lashings and lower it on its davits over the ship's side, and even if she managed to accomplish that, it was far from certain that Mungo would delay even a minute. He was more likely to sail away and leave her, as she had left the slave woman. She thought of setting fire to the ship, overturning a lantern in the mainsail locker, and creating so much damage that Huron would be obliged to call to the nearest port, Lorenzo Marx or Port Natal, to effect repairs and to give Black Joke an opportunity to come up with her. Then she imagined 800 chained slaves burning to death in the hold when the fire got out of control, and she shuddered, thrust that idea from her, and hopelessly composed herself to a sleep which would not come. In the end, her opportunity came from a most unexpected source. Tipu. The huge mate had a weakness, a single weakness that Robin could observe. He was a trencherman, and in his own taste, a gourmet. Half the lazaretto was filled with delicacies that Tipu had hoarded, and which he shared with no others. There were dried and smoked meats and sausages, cheeses, the smell of which brought tears to the eyes, and wooden crates of cans and bottles of preserved foods, though as a strict Muslim, he took no alcohol. He made up what he lacked in the glass with his spoon. His appetite was one of the ship's jokes, and Robin had heard Mungo chafing him across the wardroom table. "Were it not for the tucker you brought aboard, Mr. Mate, we'd have room for another 100 blackbirds in our hold." "I'll wager that belly of yours costs you more to sustain than a harem of extravagant wives." "Sweet merciful heavens, Mr. Tipu, whatever you were eating should have been given a Christian burial a month ago." One of Tipu's favourite appetizers was a particularly virulent bloater paste, packed in half-pound tins. The instruction printed on the tin read, "Spread thinly on biscuit or toast," and Tipu would spoon it directly from the tin, consuming the entire half-pound without once breaking the rhythmic dip and lift of his soup spoon, his eyes half-closed and a cherubic smile buckling the wide line of his toad's mouth. The fourth night out of the Rio Savi, he began his dinner with a can of bloater paste. But as he pierced the lid with his clasp knife, there was a sharp hiss of escaping gas, and Mungo St. John glanced up from his own plate of pea soup. "It is blown, Mr. Tipu. I would not eat it if I were you." "No," Tipu agreed, "but you, not me." They called Robin a little before midnight. Tipu was in convulsions, doubled up with agony, his belly swollen and hard as a yellow agate boulder. He had vomited until now he was retching only a little blood-flecked bile. "It's ptomaine poisoning," Robin told Mungo St. John. It was the first time she had spoken directly to him since that morning in the Rio Savi, and her voice was cool and formal. "I do not have the medicines to treat it. You will have to put into a port where he can receive treatment. There is a military hospital at Port Natal." "Dr. Ballantyne," Mungo answered her as formally. But his infuriating smile lurked behind the gold-flecked eyes. "Mr. Tipu's mother was an ostrich. He can digest stones, nails, and lumps of broken glass. Your concern, touching as it may be, is entirely misplaced. He will be ready to fight, flog, or devour an ox by noon tomorrow. And I tell you that without proper treatment, he will be dead in a week." However, Mungo's prognosis proved to be correct. For by morning, the vomiting and retching had abated, and Tipu seemed to have purged his bowels of the poisoned fish. Robin was forced to a decision, which she made on her knees in her cabin. "Forgive me, O Lord, but there are 800 of your children chained below decks in this foul prison, and I will not kill him. At least, with your help, I will not kill him." Then, off her knees, she went briskly to work. She used a solution of peppermint tincture to disguise the taste and let fall 15 drops of essence of ipecacuanha into the medicine glass, which was 3 times the recommended dosage for the most powerful emetic known to the medical science. "Drink it down," she told Tipu. "It will soothe your stomach and cure the diarrhea." Late that afternoon, she repeated the dose. But the wardroom steward had to help her lift Tipu's head from the bolster and pour the draught down his throat. The effect was enough to alarm even Robin. An hour later, she sent for Mungo, and the steward came back with the message. "Captain says as how the ship's safety demands all his attention at the moment, begging your pardon, Doctor." When Robin herself went on deck, Mungo was at the weather rail, sextant in hand, waiting for the sun to appear in a gap in the clouds. "Tipu is dying," she told him. "And this will be my first sight of the day," Mungo replied, without taking his eye from the eyepiece of the instrument. "I at last believe that you are a monster with no human feelings," she whispered fiercely, and at that moment blazing sunlight struck the deck as the sun showed briefly through the ragged hole in the cloud. "Stand by the chronometer," Mungo called to the signals yeoman, and then, "Mark," as he brought the sun's image down to bounce lightly as a green rubber ball on the dark line of the horizon. "Excellent," he murmured with satisfaction, as he lowered the sextant and read off the height of the sun, and called it to the yeoman to mark on his slate. Only then did he turn back to Robin. "I am sure you have misjudged the severity of Tipu's ailment." "See for yourself," she invited. "That is my intention, Doctor." Mungo stooped into Tipu's cabin and paused. His expression changed. Suddenly, the light mocking smile was gone. It was evident that Tipu was indeed dangerously ill. "How are you, old friend?" Mungo asked quietly. It was the first time Robin had ever heard him use that form of address. He lifted his hand and laid it on the mate's sweat-beaded forehead. Tipu rolled the bald yellow cannonball of his head towards Mungo, and he tried to smile. It was a brave effort. Robin felt a terrible pang of guilt at the suffering she was inflicting, and at being the witness to this private and strangely intimate moment between these two hard and dangerous men. Tipu tried to lift himself, but the effort brought a long, dragging groan rattling up his throat, and he clutched at his stomach with both hands, drawing his knees up with agony, and then desperately twisting his head as a fresh bout of heaving and retching racked his body. Mungo snatched the bucket off the deck, and with one arm around Tipu's shoulders held it for him. But all that Tipu could bring up was a little splash of blood and brown bile. And when he fell back on the bunk, he was gasping unevenly, bathed in fresh sweat, and his eyes rolled back in his skull until only a little half-moon of the iris still showed. Mungo stood beside his bunk for a full 5 minutes, bowed and attentive, swaying slightly to the ship's movement, but otherwise still and silent. His brow was creased with thought, and his gaze remote. And watching him, Robin knew he was making the dire decision. The throw of the dice of life. Friendship against the loss of his ship, and perhaps even his own liberty. For to go into a British port with slaves in his holds was an awful risk. Strange, now that he was showing his gentler side of his nature, that her affection came flooding back at full strength. She felt mean and cheap for playing on his deepest emotions and for torturing the huge yellow Moslem on the narrow bunk. Mungo swore quietly but decisively, and, still stooped under the low deck, strode from the cabin. Robin's affection turned to disgust and disappointment. Disgust that even the life of an old and loyal friend meant nothing to this cruel and merciless man whom she was doomed to love, and intense disappointment that her ruse had failed, that she had inflicted this dangerous suffering on Tipu to no avail. She sank down wearily and bitterly beside his bunk, took a cloth soaked in seawater, and bathed the sweat-basted yellow head. During their long voyage down the Atlantic, Robin had grown sensitive to all Huron's moods, to the feel of the deck underfoot at every point of sailing, and to the sounds that her hull made in different sea and wind conditions. And now, abruptly, she felt the deck cant sharply beneath her. She heard the stamp of bare feet on the deck above, as her yards were trained around and Huron's action became easier, the sounds of her hull and rigging muted as she took the wind in over her stern quarter and rowed more easily. "He's altered course to the west," she breathed as she lifted her head to listen. "It worked. He is going into Port Natal. Oh, thank you, Lord. It worked." Huron anchored well offshore, out on the 30-fathom line of the shelving coast, so that she could not benefit from the shelter of the huge whale-backed bluff that protected Port Natal's natural harbour. Even with a powerful telescope, a watcher on the shore would be unable to make out any significant details of Huron's cargo, nor of her true occupation. However, the ship paid for her offshore berth by taking the unfettered send of the sea and the wind. She pitched and she rolled and she jerked at her anchor chain. At her peak, she flew the stars and stripes of her country, and below that, the yellow Quebec, the plague flag which warned, "Stay away from me, I have plague on board." Mungo St. John placed an armed watch on both sides of the ship and others at her bow and stern, and despite Robin's strident protest, she was confined to her cabin for the duration of the ship's call, with another armed guard outside her door. "You are very well aware of the reason, Dr. Ballantyne," Mungo answered her protests calmly. "I do not wish you to have any communication whatsoever with your countrymen ashore." The whaler, when it took Tipu ashore, was rowed by men that Mungo selected personally, and they were instructed to inform the harbour master that there was smallpox aboard and to request that no other vessel be allowed near Huron. "I can only wait 3 days for you," Mungo stooped over the litter on which Tipu was carried on deck. "That is all I can risk. If you are not sufficiently recovered by then, you will have to stay here until my return. That cannot be more than 5 months." He tucked a leather drawstring purse under Tipu's blanket. "And that will pay your expenses in the meanwhile. Get well, Mr. Tipu. I need you." Robin had administered another dose of the medicine a few minutes previously, and Tipu could reply only in an agonized whisper. "I will wait for you, Captain Mungo, as long as she takes." Mungo's voice was husky as he straightened and spoke to the seaman carrying the litter. "Handle him easy, you hear me?" For 3 days, Robin sweated and fretted in the stuffy little cabin, trying to occupy her time with writing up her journals, but distracted by any loud noise from the deck above, her heart pounding as she both hoped for and dreaded the hail from a British gunboat or the rush of a boarding party coming in over Huron's side. On the third morning, Tipu was rowed back to the ship, and he climbed up the side and in through the entry port unaided. Without further doses of Epukukuana, his recovery had amazed the military surgeons ashore, but he was so thin that the skin hung in folds from his jowls like a bulldog. His belly had shrunk so that he had tied his breeches with a length of rope to keep them from sinking down past his flattened belly. But still they flapped around his shrunken buttocks. His skin was the pale yellow of ancient ivory, and he was so weak he had to pause to rest when he reached the deck. "Welcome aboard, Mr. Tipu," Mungo called from the quarter-deck. "And if you have finished your holiday ashore, I'll thank you to get this ship underway immediately."